Hey, it's Hal Elrod, author of The Miracle Morning, and you're listening to Capital Hacking with Josh and Eric. Enjoy.
On today's episode of Capital Hacking,
individuals are feeling, why can't we have a discussion and share what we're buying and encourage others to buy a stock? If you look at Wall Street, one can make a comparison and say, if a big bank has a team of analysts who are promoting those companies to their clients, isn't that the same thing in essence? So why shouldn't individuals be able to do that? And I think that's a valid debate to have.
Responsibility.
I could do this all day.
Zip, don't get scared now.
They may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
Cinderella's story, out of nowhere.
It's in the hole!
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself!
Capital Hacking begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to Capital Hacking. Eric and I are so glad you decided to come back to this incredible, nationally recognized audio mastermind. Don't be afraid, folks. Do not be afraid. The Capital Hacking community is truly a game changer, not a game stopper, but a game changer in the world of podcasting, where we've crossed through the looking glass, Eric and I, and we have metamorphosized into an audio mastermind where when you're at the table here or driving in your Tesla, you are changing. Your mind is expanding and masterminding. Feel free to participate. Chime right in. Speak right to the iPod, which is what it used to be called, and just say your answers back as we probe our guests for the wisdom and the conversation that changes the world. So, well, Eric, I hope I did all right on that intro.
I am very impressed. You nailed it. If I had a card here, it wouldn't be an 8 or a 9. I'd lift up a 10 card. You landed it. It was perfect.
We're trying.
Maybe I love 9. It. I love it.
Well, see, it's because we're getting excited to have Andy Wang on the show. You know, Andy Wang was on the show before, and he's from Runnymede Capital Management, which means he uses the word capital in the name of his business, which means he should be on the show because our show is called Capital Hacking. Therefore, ipso facto, it's like he's a co-host.
He's a returning professor as well, right? Because isn't he?
Well, anyway, I love how right when we needed a laugh track, it beeped. he got like a ding, like Microsoft said, I'm Andy Wang. No, Andy Wang, welcome to the show.
Thank you so
welcome
much.
Back.
Yes, Capital Hacking, Runnymede Capital Management. We're cousins.
You know, buddy, listen, you're in the world of the stocks, okay? We are not in the world of the stocks. We have so much to ask you today, so much to know about the world of the stocks. But before we do that, Eric and I love to know a little bit more about you. Well, Andy, do you have a family? What's your backstory? How can you introduce yourself to our guests, our listeners?
Well, I was born in a galaxy far, far away. What am I? I'm a financial advisor, owner of Runnymede Capital Management. It's a family-owned business. I work with my father, my brother. We have a small team, and we serve individuals and business owners and some institutions or some businesses. But yes, I have a family. I'm working at home. My 3 kids are upstairs in school, in virtual school right now. Actually, they'll go back to in-person school on Monday. But for the last 10 days, we've been doing virtual school. So it's been chaotic in my house. I have 3 kids. There's never a boring moment at my house. And what else about me? I play Hawaiian music. My wife was born and raised in Hawaii, so I play Hawaiian music.
Is that how you swooned her? Is that how you swooned her originally?
I don't think so, because when we met, I was really, really bad at Hawaiian music.
That's
luckily
the women sometimes like to take care of the injured dog and the injured puppy. Maybe
she saw potential. I'll say that. And yeah, some crazy adventures on the music front. I mean, I played music for Christie Brinkley one time. I performed for Daniel Day Kim of Hawaii 5-0. I've had some crazy adventures on the music front that I never expected would have happened.
Don't you have a Don Ho story in there somewhere?
Yeah. Do you have a Don Hoff story?
Christie Brinkley, as it turns out, her stepfather was a, you know, writer and producer of TV shows, lived in Beverly Hills, but split his time between California and Hawaii. So she grew up going to Hawaii a lot as a child and has a connection to the islands. So when her parents passed away, she planted a tree out in the Hamptons in her town and wanted to make a dedication to that tree, invited close family and friends, and wanted a piece of Hawaii there. And I got to be that piece. She invited me out. I got to play some music for probably about 15 friends and family. Christie Brinkley was super, super nice. She pulled up. I had kind of set up in this park where they planted the tree earlier that day. This like full grown tree, which is kind of crazy. And an SUV pulled up. Christie Brinkley got out. She came right over to me, welcomed me, told me how she was excited to have me there to be part of this tree dedication and to bring part of, you know, a piece of Hawaii to this family like memorial. You know, she was so personable. It was a blast. It was nice to be part of that like intimate event. And then afterwards, she said, we're going to go across the street to this Italian restaurant. If you want to join us, you're welcome. So I got to join her three kids and her family friends.
Now, don't tell the end of the story on air, because you and I, when I got you drunk the other night, I remember getting the story out of you. And it turns out she ran on the bill. She jumped. She said she had to go to the bathroom and she walked out the back door. Who would have ever thought Christie would drop
it's
you with
unreal.
That bill like that?
How dare she?
Awful.
That is Josh's version of the story. I neither drink nor have heard that version before.
Oh, you know what could be better than great humor like that? Money talk that's inspired, like inspired money. If we could just inspire some money, that would be the way to land this ship. Because that's the other thing about you, my friend. You're a famous, famous podcaster, the host behind the Inspired Money podcast show, correct?
The tireless host. Over 170 episodes published weekly for over 3 years. Most of those episodes by the very qualified team of me, myself, and I. My wife is asking me when I'm going to get a return on that investment of time, but it is something that I really, really enjoy.
Today, she say, today, honey, I was on Capital Hacking. That don't happen by just, luck. You got to bring the power to get on Capital Hacking.
It just paid off.
We're so happy to mark this day. Right? Today will be the day that lives in your family's infamy. No, we know you have the best guests. As a matter of fact, you've had some amazing guests, haven't you?
It's been a blast. The podcast, you guys know that having a podcast, hosting a podcast, it is a platform that allows you to, it opens the doors to talk to all kinds of interesting people that you would not otherwise have access to. Yes, the guests that I've had kind of blow my mind. I got to interview Guy Kawasaki recently, author Derek Sivers, who's very well known for his TED Talks and starting a movement. We're talking about a movement about a dancing guy. Derek is a minimalist. So, and also previously, he's most well known for founding CD Baby, the largest independent music distributor, and selling that company for
like the Columbia Records stuff back in the day with checkbox things.
Can I jump in? I remember Please. Using CD Baby when I was in a band, and that was one of the publishing. They would press our music on discs, right, Andy? Is that who it was?
Derek has a crazy story because he was a musician himself, studied music at Berkeley. He performed in the circus. He was a circus musician. And you know, would get paid like $500 per gig. He lived in Manhattan, worked in the recording industry for a while where, I mean, brutal grunt work, right? He was in the studio for like, I don't know, 70 hours a week or something and getting paid minimum wage. Of course, you're getting exposed to really cool musicians and things like that, but you're not making much of a living. So he was actually making more money on the weekends playing these circus gigs. But he's a minimalist, so he would spend close to like zero. I think he was spending like $10 a day on food or something because he was subsisting on peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. He never ate out. He never took a taxi. He would only take the subway. So because of that, like if he made $500 a month, he was wealthy because his expenses were so low.
What an interesting principle. No, I love that. You know, let's jump into a couple really hot topics that our audience right now, I'm sure they're tweeting right at us through the ether. So let's get into the fact that on the show Capital Hacking, we meet so many wonderful people that do real estate investing, real asset investing, and we don't get to have too many Andy Wangs on the phone, okay? And you're on the podcast because of our connection. We love you, and we love your Inspired Money business show. So tell us a little bit about the way your business works as a financial advisor. Share with us like the workflow and what led you into this business, if you don't mind me asking.
This is a family business. So my dad was once research director at the Bank of New York. He ran the research department, followed about, I don't know, a few hundred companies. He had 40 analysts working under him. And in that time, he visited hundreds of companies. He would visit Caterpillar Tractor. He would visit Maytag, following appliance companies. And he did that for about 10 years. After that, the bank had a money management subsidiary that he was president and also chief investment officer. So he was managing the bank's pension fund as well as outside customers. And ultimately, he opened his own shop in 1993, Runnymede Capital Management, because he had spent basically his whole career at the bank, being at a large organization, and had this immigrant's dream of owning his own business. So struck out on his own, was very fortunate to have the bank among his initial clients. And I joined him in 1998. My younger brother, Chris, was at the College Retirement Equities Fund in New York. He joined us in 2003. So it's like father, two sons. It's very much a family business. That's how I came into it. But I grew up in a family where my mom had been a stockbroker at Merrill Lynch when she went back to work. And we would actually have like dinner conversations about return on equity and, you know, is a company's margins increasing or decreasing? And it's something that, I don't know, it's kind of strange conversations to have around the dinner table when I was a kid, but it just felt normal because that's what happened. You know, talking about business cycles and talking about debt to equity, things like that. So when I joined my dad, we're fee-only financial advisors. We work with individuals, with families. We work with some businesses and nonprofits to either do some financial planning for them and or to manage their investable assets. So for us, that means publicly traded stocks, bonds, coming up with what the asset allocation or what the portfolio mix will be, and really trying to assess what is a client's goals and objectives, what is their, you know, tolerance for risk, and then putting together a portfolio that aligns with their goals.
Yeah, I mean, so let me, since we don't get to have people like you too often on the phone, which we're very grateful to have you, would you mind if we ask you a few 101 class questions?
Not at all.
And ask you for a little help of, so
I hope that I can answer.
Oh,
that.
Yeah, you're in 101.
Otherwise, I'm going to get thrown out of here.
You're going to get thrown out of here. It's 50-50 right now. But by the way, do you have a logoed mug that you want to flash to the audience here? They'd love to see Inspired Money.
I've got the Inspired Money.
Nice. Woo,
look at that. That's a rich guy with a fancy Yeti mug. Steel. So tell us a little bit about these terms and which ones are the ones if we were new to stock, would want to get our heads around. Let's just ask the ones you already brought up. Return on equity at the dinner table. What would be an explanation of what that is in the world of stock?
Return on equity is really like, how profitable is the company? Are they making money? You know, of their stock that is out there, are they making a return? And, you know, you're going to calculate a number and, it's giving an indication of profitability, the ability for a company to make money. It's like if you put a dollar in, how much are you getting out?
Would you mind doing a demonstration? Like, again, it helps sometimes we all learn differently. Can you think of a mid-sized business or maybe a $1 billion company that's a sizable company? A $1 billion company is the equity in that case would be that's how much stock has been sold. Or that's their market cap? Is that what you mean by return on equity? Do you take that number and divide the profits?
I guess the like academic definition or a business school definition would be that you're measuring a company's financial performance and you're calculating it by dividing the net income by the shareholder's equity. And the shareholder's equity is the company's assets minus its debt. Right. I mean, I think that these are terms that are not dissimilar from real estate. But you're really trying to get a sense of return on equity. That's the return on the net assets. And like I said, that's like how you're trying to get a picture of are you getting money out of this? Is the company generating money or not? And you can make a comparison then if you're looking at company A versus company B and try to make an assessment which one is more attractive.
Exactly. So you might decide you're in the healthcare business sector, you'd believe in the future trajectory, then you're going to grab four great competitors and you're going to say which one do we put our highest position in? And then you're going to do return of equity. Now, return on equity. What would be a normal rate of return on equity? 5%, 2%, 1%, 100%. What's the return on equity percentage ballpark so we understand the number scale?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to totally vary company to company and also industry by industry. But I think you're looking generally for, you know, I guess let's start with like a benchmark. So if you take the S&P 500 as a whole, so you're taking 500 of like some of the largest companies in the US, I think the return on equity is roughly 14% as an acceptable ratio. So in general terms, anything less than 10%, you might consider poor. Anything greater is gonna be better than average, right? Anything greater than the 14%, you say, oh, that's better than the S&P 500.
Got it. I like that. That gives me a little something to work with.
Yeah, these are things that I wasn't expecting to talk about today. So
We're gonna go deep dive. We got three more, bro. We got three more.
Wait, maybe four. Let me ask this one, Josh, because I'm wondering, from the real estate perspective, all the listeners out there who analyze deals, you know, we always, you know, try to minimize our risk by analyzing and projecting what's potentially going to occur. How do you do that with stock and corporations? So you analyze it, you know, based off of everything you said, but then how do you potentially project their earnings, you know, 5-10 years ahead? How do you read the tea leaves?
Yeah, this is something that I think I have unique insight into because my dad ran a research department at a large bank. And his comment was always that you have great analysts who follow industries, right? And individual companies within industries. And he feels like in doing that job, in filling that role, that they tend to have a very good sense of what's happening in those companies. What are the industry trends? Are trends improving or are they decelerating? But the biggest challenge has always been, how do you calculate the valuation and figure out what you're willing to pay for that company? I think that part of that gap is that oftentimes they don't even teach that in business school. I don't know. Some of the approaches today tend to be, you can take like a cash flow model and try to predict, but there are so many inputs, it gets very confusing. At our company, we try to simplify that process by reducing the number of inputs. So usually we're looking at a company's earnings growth. And then, I don't know, this is going to get deep in the weeds, but you know, if you look at a bond as like a safe investment and a rate of return, you figure that a stock is going to have like, you have to assign like some sort of higher risk premium. But if you treat every investment comparing it to a bond, then you start saying, all right, if there's an earnings stream or earnings growth of 15%, you can start making a comparison. What are you willing to pay? So we're calculating kind of using that ratio and ending up with a sort of low end, we get a price range for all the companies that we follow, because we do feel like it is important to know, what are you paying? Is it reasonable or is it overpriced? Because in doing that, you're trying to control your risk a little bit.
Well done. Well done. Great question, Eric. Way better than mine. Thank God. I'm so glad you're here to add wisdom to the show.
I hope we still have some listeners after that.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
No, dude. There are 75 listeners saying, hey, get on the phone. You got to listen to me. By the way, you don't have to hurry up and call us or anything like that. I had a phone symbol because you can actually just listen to this podcast. You can share it with your friends. Everybody's sharing it right this minute. Thank you very much for doing that.
Hi, this is Melanie McCallan. Josh and I are just so grateful for the many investors who already joined us at Accountable Equity. Accountable Equity is so much more than a capital group. It's really a community of accredited investors that want to learn and grow together. I just want to personally invite you, if you want to find out more about this type of investment and see if it's right for you and your family, please visit us at accountableequity.com.
Guys, this is Josh here. Melanie and I have something important to share. A little while ago, we learned a big life-changing truth, and that is that you need to have control over your own capital. It was actually the cash flow ninja, MC Laubscher, who showed us, our own family, how to set up our own banking system. I know, it's hard to understand. So what MC did is he put together a webinar that will change your life like it changed Melanie and mine. So through the Infinite Banking System, you can create and control your own banking system to leverage your own capital to grow your own business, supercharge your investments. In this free webinar, MC will share how to set up your own banking system. The website is incredibly easy. It's yourownbankingsystem.com. Yourownbankingsystem.com.
This is MC Laubscher, the Cashflow Ninja, and you're listening to the Capital Hacking Podcast.
Can we veer off a little bit more? And I know you have questions, Josh, because he said something there, overvalued. And we were talking earlier before the mics turned on about overvaluing companies. And we see a trend now, and this is very topical. So at the time of year listening to this, Josh mentioned GameStop. What's your take on what's happening with Robinhood, GameStop, AMC, all these companies that are, you know, there's the talk of the town and everybody's trying to get
and could you set the stage too, yeah. Andy? Like, what happened? And then tell us what you think.
Yes,
of it,
please.
Because I don't even quite know what happened.
It's I'm so with you. Confusing. I have no idea what happened.
GameStop is super interesting. It's something that I've been watching super closely over the last week and a half, and it's unlike anything I've ever seen in my career. But I think I bring a little bit of a different perspective because I'm actually one of the few financial advisors who bought GameStop, not only for myself, but for my clients. This is before the stock just went like parabolic. But let me start here that we started looking at GameStop back in December. And the reason was we had owned a company called Chewy, which is kind of like the Amazon of pet supplies and pet food. They are the premier brand for online pet supplies. And surprisingly, while Amazon does sell pet supplies and pet food, they're not strongest in that vertical. And it opened the opportunity for Chewy to build a very strong brand, build a strong following. And the founder of Chewy and the former CEO of Chewy back in December took a 10% stake in GameStop. And since we were shareholders of Chewy, we took notice and we said, what's going on at GameStop? We know that it's a retailer that sells new and used video games. During the pandemic, there had been an increase in demand for video games, right? There are a lot of kids at home needing things to do. They're buying video games. The parents are like, we got to get these kids a game console because we need to get these kids like off our backs. So games have been super popular. So we took a look at GameStop. We did our own research. And what we found was that we believe that Wall Street's earnings estimates, their earnings forecast for 2021, we think it's too low. Wall Street's forecasting a loss of 6 cents. And we think that their earnings should be much higher. So today, when GameStop is the talk of the town, and most of the articles all say there are no fundamentals here, this makes zero sense, I think that's oversimplifying things. I think that the Wall Street earnings estimates do indeed show no fundamentals, but I think that their earnings estimates are off. Because if you look at history, whenever there's a new game console coming into the market, that then GameStop's earnings usually do quite well. And in 2020, we had the Sony PS5 come out and the Microsoft Xbox Series X. You had two game systems that are in high demand. There have been shortages going into the holidays. They were very hard to find and buy these consoles. But I think that that's going to result in positive earnings surprise throughout this year, because those new gaming systems, customers go to GameStop to buy the game system and games. I guess the other thing is that GameStop has been probably the most hated stock by Wall Street. And many hedge funds have been betting against GameStop, also known as selling stock short. So they don't own the stock, but they're borrowing stock to sell it without owning it, with the idea that they're trying to sell low and then they buy it back at a lower price. So you're doing the opposite of what you would normally do with the stock, which is try to buy low, sell high. And the rationale there was that everybody, well, those guys, the guys betting against GameStop, they were saying that GameStop is going to be the next Blockbuster, because gaming is going to go digital. It's going to be like movies and go to streaming, and there's going to be no need for a retail store. But I think it's premature to call for the complete demise of GameStop, because these two new game systems that I talked about, they still have DVD drives in them, and people are still buying the game discs. So we think that, you know, it goes back to the earnings. We think that GameStop could earn like somewhere in the range of $2 to $3. So if Wall Street has the earnings forecast, if they're wrong, we think that there is some like positive fundamental here that could drive the stock higher. One more thing, going back to the former CEO of Chewy, Ryan Cohen, he has a investment company. In January, he increased his investment in GameStop to about 13%. And they also announced that he would become a board member at GameStop and bring two more board members to the board of GameStop. So you've got like an activist investor who has painted a vision of possibly transforming this kind of tired game retailer into what could become a specialized e-commerce retailer of gaming products. But our view is that if his pie in the sky vision comes into fruition, like I think the optimistic view was that the stock could sell at like $100 or a little over $100. What we have seen in the last week and a half is that, because I mentioned that there's a lot of people or a lot of hedge funds shorting this stock to, I don't know what the figure is. I think they said it was like 140% of the available stock was being sold short, which I don't understand how more than 100% can be sold short. But either way, a very high number of the shares outstanding were being sold short. So you had individual investors in Reddit groups, in Discord groups, all trying to collectively buy and drive the stock price up, knowing that they could force these hedge funds who had short positions and were betting against it, if they want to get out of their positions to limit their losses, they have to buy the stock back, which drives the stock up further. So that's what's known as a short squeeze. When people are covering their shorts because the stock is going up, the stock goes up like a, you know, it's like an elastic band. And that's what we've been seeing, which is insane.
Can you give us an idea of how much it's grown since, like, say, when you jumped in late last year to now? Like, what's the numbers?
Yes, I can. Because back in December and then early January, which is when we started buying, we kind of bought two rounds of GameStop for our clients. First in December, and I think we were paying roughly $16 for those shares. And then we bought some more in probably around January 6th, and that was under $18. The stock went up to, well, I think yesterday it traded as high as $480. It's crazy.
And that's amazing.
And you've never seen that. You said you've never seen that before.
I've never seen this before. We have clients that we have sold some of their positions, and like we have clients that we realize gains of like 6 times their initial investment. And that's in a period of just over a month holding period. So normally, if you get that kind of return in 10 years, you're pretty happy. To get that in just over a month is insanity.
You know, there's a myriad of questions to ask about this. So I think if you don't mind, since this show is going to go down as the one where Andy Wang became the expert, you know, in so many people's minds, you know, someone who thinks things through, who thinks about inspired money, who can actually explain the complicated pretty easily and pretty well and seems trustworthy. So I hope that you get a lot of new people to call you and say, you know, I do need some position in stock market. But before we let you get flooded with phone calls from our audience and make you a millionaire because all of our audience wants to work with you, forget that. You need to earn it, baby. So let's go back and talk about what happens when GameStop. Let's think about it. I was just on their site, and not their site, but the stock market rankings, and it kept track of it. It had gotten as low as $4 a share in 2020. And it is now, again, the other day was 483 it reached. So when a stock does that, you even said earlier, when you were buying it at 17, your argument was it was undervalued because it will be a business that earns money, not just a speculative crapshoot. But now it's at 400 plus. What happens now? Now it can't be an investment anymore, right? I mean, the metrics are messed up at this point, right? There's no way you could earn the equivalent to that market valuation today, it seems to me. Teach me what I'm missing. It's almost like it has to go down now, or it could go up a little bit, but it's not valued intrinsically at this number. So what happens to GameStop going forward?
This is where it gets very tricky or difficult to predict. I think one takeaway is that by the time everybody's talking about it, it's usually too late. So I would caution people who are reading about GameStop and feeling the FOMO, the fear of missing out. I think it's very dangerous here. And the distinction is that there's a clear difference between investing and speculating. And you have to know when one turns into the other. You know, at $20, I felt like we were looking at GameStop as an investment. We could really analyze what do we think that the company can earn in 2021 relative to what Wall Street analysts were saying. And they were saying that the company is going to lose 6 cents this year. And we think that it's going to earn like somewhere between $2 and $3. So we could assign some value, like do some valuation calculation. But based on that, we thought that the stock could sell around $30 to $40 from the $20 sort of entry price when we were looking. Now that you've got like individuals all over the world piling into a stock, and it's not just GameStop. It's not just GameStop. Investors are specifically looking for companies with high short interest. And that with a combination of a low dollar price. And if they can collectively jam in there, they're trying to drive it up. And in some sense, you can call that manipulation. But I think with GameStop, once the stock is over $100, it turns into a bubble. It becomes a bubble. It's very much like the internet bubble when you had companies that had no earnings selling at $300. Very similar. And once you have a bubble, it's very difficult to predict. You can't value it. You can't know when the bubble pops. You don't know how long it will last. So, you know, could GameStop go to 500? Could it go to 1,000? I say that it's possible. Like anything's possible, because when you've got a bubble, it's just so unpredictable. But ultimately, the music stops and things turn back to normal. So like the rocket ship has to come back to Earth. and you do not want to be the last person when the music stops and you can't find your seat. That's a problem.
Have you liquidated all your positions?
We've sold about 90% of our positions.
Good.
And
great.
Held
good
on position. To about 10%, just knowing that we don't know what happens in a bubble, and figure that if we hold on to a small portion, you know, we can see what happens. But we booked profits, and it's been a crazy time. Like I said, I've never experienced anything like this as far as appreciation in this amount of time. And, you know, it's a good problem to have, but it's been very interesting fielding client questions over the last week and a half. Yeah, interestingly, I think a lot of clients haven't even noticed because they don't look at their account, but more and more clients have been sending emails, sending texts, and calling, curious to know, when are we going to sell? What's happening?
I got a question regarding this new sort of strategy to identify companies that are using this method, you know, with short selling and, you know, the hedge funds trying to take advantage. Now everyone's aware this happened to GameStop. Let's look for other companies. What's happening within the industry that I'm noticing with Robinhood and other sort of platforms is that they're trying to regulate and control what's happening. Do you foresee the financial industry or in Wall Street starting to get into more regulation and control around what's happening if this continues?
Well, it's very early, so it's tough to know how this is going to play out. I think that regulators are concerned and they want to protect individuals, assuming that in a bubble, individual investors tend to be the ones who like get hurt. And they're trying to figure out how do they protect individual investors. But at the same time, I think a lot of the investors feel like, why are you bringing regulation in to sort of hinder what they want to do? Like, that's not fair. There's like an equity discussion that's happening. And I think it's an interesting philosophical discussion because individuals are feeling, why can't we have a discussion and share what we're buying and encourage others to buy a stock? What's wrong with that? When if you look at Wall Street, one can make a comparison and say, if a big bank has a team of analysts who are writing reports on a company and then promoting those companies to their clients, isn't that the same thing in essence? So why shouldn't individuals be able to do that? And I think that's a valid debate to have.
You know what, Eric, forgive me for the listeners. We skipped a step. So going back before the regulation, like what happened that what you're describing? Are you saying that people like two young people who are pretending to be analysts for a minute, they're like, hey, we should all buy GameStop. Is that what happened? And then that's how the market rose up? And you're saying that us writing that text back and forth and those that we should be regulated is what the government's saying. If you could just set a context, because I'm a little lost, forgive me.
So you've got GameStop, which was a very widely hated stock. Like many hedge funds were betting against it. They were calling it the next blockbuster, could go bankrupt. So they are betting that it's going to go from $20 to zero. And they're betting big money because some of these hedge funds are like multi-billion dollar funds making big bets. On the other side of that, you've got individuals who said, you know what? I don't think that this stock should have 140% short interest. Let's buy the stock and drive it up.
And they wrote on Reddit and things like that. So it's as if they de facto became analysts.
Yes. And
they're like armchair analysts and they all talked to each other.
Yeah. And what's really
media.
Difficult to know when you go into these groups. And let me clarify that, you know, it's not just like two people getting together. The subreddit group, I think, has 3.8 million members or people in it. So you've got a large number of people from all over the world. And that's just one subreddit group. There are other groups that are on Discord, like they're using these gaming platforms to communicate. And they have like hundreds of thousands of individual investors in there. You've got sort of low barrier to entry because of companies like Robinhood, where you can open an account with an app. You've got commission-free trading. So it's just very easy to start buying stocks or, you know, exchange-traded funds. And I think it's also like a pandemic phenomenon too, because you've had students who are home from school. You have people who would normally be at work and now they're either out of work or they're at home and they have more free time. So there has been just a lot of, there's been growing interest in trading stocks and trying to make money in the stock market. So when you've got 3.8 million people plus getting together and saying, we're all going to buy GameStop no matter what the price is, because we know that these hedge funds have to get out of their positions and then the stock's going to go up more. So they collectively did that. And that's why we saw the stock like doubling every day for 3 or 4 days.
And all of a sudden, Robinhood, I'm speaking maybe self-evident truth, but these mediums or applications shut down the ability to buy it.
Yeah, they started putting restrictions in place, limiting what the individuals could do on the app. And I'm not sure, I don't know like all the factors taking place. I think when that started happening on the surface, the reaction was that the individuals were objecting, saying, you know what, this is the establishment trying to stick it to us, and this is not fair. I don't know exactly what was happening. Some articles say that a lot of these apps and companies, they're actually using another company behind the scenes who is handling like the back office clearing and trade processing. And it was those companies that were actually putting the restrictions because they were worried that if people are borrowing money to buy stocks, that just the risk was increasing to them and to like the whole system. So they started putting some things in place to limit, you know, what people could do with options and buying the stock. Some of those things are starting to come back. So there may be some truth there that, you know, the underlying companies who were behind the scenes were trying to put some like measures in place for safety. But then as things are developing, they're starting to reopen what the individual traders can and cannot do.
And at the end of the day, let's assume the price holds for a while and there's a detente, as they say. You know, there's no liquidation, radical liquidation. There's no more short selling, whatever you call it, short covering. And the business now just keeps operating. Okay, so because all of what you and I just described technically didn't affect how many consoles were sold at GameStop this week, right? And this week they made a marginal small profit this week. Let's assume, paraphrase. Now their business has got this massive artificial market cap. What happens to a company like that? Let's assume it holds for a while. Doesn't that mess with the whole operation of the company? Like they're like, we could liquidate or we have equity here. What is it's almost like it creates a new problem for the management of the company, I would think.
Yeah, you know, I think I don't know if it can stay there. I mean, looking at sort of different valuation metrics, I think 2 days ago at the close, GameStop had a larger total market value than the retailer Dollar Tree. But Dollar Tree has about 3.5 times more sales and is more profitable. So in making that comparison, I start seeing like GameStop, it doesn't make a lot of sense at this moment. But if what you're saying, you could have a situation where the stock remains somewhere around $300 to $400, or it could go up even higher. If that happens, then I don't know. Does it? I guess the impact is that suddenly the company has this stock price and currency that they could use to acquire other businesses. But it's not impossible right. to have a high valuation. Right. I think that if you look at Tesla, which has been an extremely, you know, it's been a stock that has appreciated a lot. And you compare like the price to sales of Tesla versus price to sales of GameStop, Tesla is still much higher. So could GameStop stay at these levels? It could. Should it? Maybe not, but...
You made a really interesting point. You said it earlier that some of the positives you saw from the fundamentals point of view and the business trajectory had to do with their pivot several months ago, that they were going to become perhaps change with the times and leverage their new CEO's. Okay, so now this new CEO, I don't even care if we talk about the person, but that person's talents, if they're truly innovative, with this newfound market cap, you could almost think there could be like an interesting financial magic that could happen where they could leverage their new high market cap into implementing all his new or her new creative ideas. But I don't know how you, there begs the question, how do you, as the CEO and the administration or the chair, the board, capitalize on high market valuation? Because you don't have that money, right? I mean, that money was between me and Eric. We traded back and forth. I'm the dog. He made all the money, but the money never really touched GameStop's books. Like the money never hit them, right? Because we were aftermarket trading.
Just to clarify, it's not the CEO. It's Ryan Cohen who owns about a 13% stake, and he's going to become a board member. It's too early to tell right now whether his vision is going to happen, because the company hasn't even made any moves other than to accept some new board seats. I think Cohen doesn't actually join the board until June. So the announcement has been made, but he's not physically there yet. It like that vision is an idea, like what could the company become? And we don't even know, like, what does that mean? Like, what is his vision? What is he going to execute to make that happen? But certainly, if the stock price is selling at a very high price and multiple, he could, you know, the company could go make acquisitions of all kinds of digital platforms or gaming, you know, all kinds of like new gaming sort of delivery or streaming platforms. We saw that back in the days of the internet, where companies had no business plan at that time, but because their stock price was so high, they could then actually acquire real companies that were making a profit using their company in exchange for company stock. And it's like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? I guess if you've got a stock price that you can use as currency and start acquiring other businesses, you could create something just because you have that currency that you didn't have before.
Well, I mean, we're not going to be able to solve world hunger or dissect GameStop any further, but if you are listening, Ryan, what's Ryan's last name again?
Ryan Cohen.
You know what, Mr. Cohen, I know you're listening to the show. If you're listening and you're an activist board member, here's what I would do. I would immediately get down there and say to the guys and ladies, here's an idea. We capitalize on this right now. Change it, pivot to a new strategy. Say that we're using the market capitalization to make these acquisitions, because ultimately the name GameStop, which to me represented a corner kiosk in a mall when I was younger, could quickly become Netflix, right? Netflix started with a CD in a piece of paper, but they chose a name that sounded like the future. You know, GameStop digitally sounds like the future, not the past. It's kind of a mind bender. If they jump on this right now, capitalizing on their paper value, capitalizing on quote unquote a new strategy, and almost taking the credit that it was the impetus for the growth, they really could become a solid company and acquire, like you said. Very cool.
Well, I think that's where it gets interesting, because if Cohen comes in on the board and their stock is still selling at a very high price, that could accelerate his vision to make it actually happen and actually happen faster.
Yeah, I mean, like Netflix of video games, perhaps. Maybe that already exists, but they could be the dominant player in the future if they pull it off.
Yeah, I think that's his vision. And the question is, we don't even know what that looks like yet, but a high stock price will help him to achieve that.
We went deep and we drove all this stuff so far home that this became our official GameStop show, which is cool because that means we're topical. And since Eric is helping us produce it, maybe he can topically send it out pretty quickly. So we love you, Andy. Eric doesn't love you as much as I do, but I still think he likes you. Andy, what would you like to say to the people about how they could follow up with you?
Thank you guys for having me back on the show. It's always good to talk about Capital and Hacking on Capital Hacking.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. People can find me at inspiredmoney.fm. There you will find Runnymede Capital, same site, and also the Inspired Money podcast, where we talk to different guests about positive money stories in hopes of inspiring you to look at your own finances.
Andy, we have not had you at the wonderful Renault Winery and Resort. So someday you got to come down. Maybe we'll have him speak to our tribe as well, Josh. You know, it's all local. But yeah, thanks for coming on the show, brother. We appreciate you.
Thanks, guys.
We'll talk to you soon and we'll sign off here. And next time we'll talk a little bit more about your dad's awesome capital hack of creating Runnymede. I wrote that down as like, this dude launched his business on the back of one major contract. And now look at it. It's become a family legacy. So
we're still here.
Congratulations, Mr. Capital Hacker, Mr. Andy Wang's dad. All right, we will talk to you guys later. Thank you.
Wow. Wow. You made it, everybody. Thank you so much. Eric and I have always said that the people who join us at the end get the pearl and the prize.
Awesome. Folks, don't forget to like and share and love what we're doing on social media. If you want to hit up Josh, you want to hit me up, those are the best places to find us. We are always camped out and ready to talk and put the fire on.
We stand by on social media. But by the way, I know we're on Capital Hacking at Instagram, Capital Hacking on Facebook, and Capital Hacking on my personal favorite, LinkedIn.
Yes, because you can always find major players on LinkedIn. I know your favorite. These are some power players on LinkedIn always.
Gary Vee, he's my boy.
But Gary Vee also talks about the power of Instagram. So if you also want to find us there, we're doing a lot of really cool, sexy things on Instagram. So always you can reach out and DM us on Instagram if you have any questions or you want our time. We are always camped out and living there as well.
We will get right back to you. And just like we always say, you are now part of the team. This is a team that's here to add value to your life, and thank you for adding so much value to our life. Remember to share this podcast. Helps us grow it bigger and bigger each week, and we appreciate you posting a review on iTunes. You cannot believe how powerful that is.
Absolutely. Like and share this with anyone and everyone that you think it will add value to, and we appreciate all of that love and support. And do not forget, with great power comes great responsibility. Woo!